dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battlefronts in that war at the moment is what is developing as a result of President Trump's decision to remove U.S. forces from first the front lines of the fight with the Turks in northeastern Syria, and now pretty much all of northern Syria. To discuss this, I'm pleased to say we are joined by Matt Brodsky. Matt is a frequent contributor to this program and a senior fellow at the Gold Institute for International Strategy. He writes prolifically on these topics and has been very, very, well, forthright, shall we say, in his criticism about President Trump and the decision he made that has now precipitated things we want to talk with him a bit about and what may come next. Matt, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
So tell us a little bit about your assessment of the president's decision and where we are as things stand now in its aftermath.
Well, to be clear, when President Trump was running for office, he was saying that the defeat of ISIS, the pushback on Iran, and a peace agreement between Israel and Palestinians that for sure kept Israel secure. These were the three priorities he's had in the Middle East. He has catastrophically undermined every single part of his Middle East policy. The withdrawal basically means now that we have wasted around $40 billion since he's been as president. That's how much we've wasted continuing to be in the Syrian war. Because, frankly, we're giving everything back to our enemies but improved locations as Russia is currently taking over the bases that we were just in, a day ago. So on every single conceivable level, this has been a complete disaster. Strategically, we were keeping 30% of the country pacified. So this wasn't like an active war. And from that, we were ensuring the enduring defeat of ISIS, which will now be reconstituted and resurgent. And Iran, we were blocking at least one or two of the main overland routes that Iran was using to get to the Mediterranean. One of those will now have a border crossing in the north that they never even really dreamed of having. We just gave it up on a silver platter. And we gave up all our leverage to control any aspect of Syria's future, where without owning the entire Syrian mess, we could have at least maintained a say, as a world power should have, in what the future looks like there. Morally, to just turn on an ally like this is completely, just frankly, disgusting. I mean, we've been trying to get Russia to dump Iran as its proxy, and we are the only country to have just turned on our own proxy and then to try to sell it as though, they were fighting for their own land, as if we went to the beaches of Normandy in World War II and decided, we're not going to go ashore. Britain is fighting for its own land. You know, this isn't their big deal. So, whatever, this isn't for us. That's a ridiculous kind of statement. Politically, it seems like it's incredibly risky. Procedurally, though, and here this is even, I think, as frustrating as the rest, is frankly, even if you think that what we should do is completely dump on our ally and try to realign with Turkey, there's not a single thing that was done here that was done correctly, that was done to advance American interests. We completely gave away all of our leverage in exchange for absolutely nothing. We had something that Turkey wanted, that Russia wanted, that Assad and Iran wanted, and we gave it away for absolutely nothing. And I got to say, if this is how we conducted a negotiation with one phone call to Erdogan, it makes you wonder what a nuclear agreement with either North Korea or Iran would look like, because this was the worst negotiation I have seen.
strong views. I think there are quite a number of us who share them, and I appreciate your very forthright way in conveying the character of the decision that was made and the way it has been playing out. Talk to us, Matt Brodsky, about the mission that Mike Pompeo and Vice President Pence are now embarked on to Turkey in the aftermath of this decision, the prospects that some salvaging will be able to be made there, and what do you think that would look like if it were possible?
Well, I mean, at the moment, just within the span of a few hours, Erdogan said that he's not even going to meet with them. Then he reversed his decision, which is everything that has happened since then, since we have zero leverage in this entire area now, since Trump just gave it away. Very little is going to possibly come from it. The sanctions that the president announced are not strong enough to actually reverse something. And everything that we've seen happen in the past week is all what you would need to have worked out on the very phone call that Trump had with Erdogan. So we're trying to scramble to get a piece of the pie back when we had the entire portion of the pie. And now we're doing it without leverage. And the fact, incidentally, that Erdogan knows that he doesn't really, it doesn't matter what he says to Pence and to Ambassador Jeffrey and Pompeo, because he has a standing invite to the White House in November. That is simply unconscionable, but that's the reality. So I don't see how he's going to want to give anything to Trump's underlings, even if we had leverage, if he's got an invite to see President Trump as an honored guest at the White House next month.
I fully expect that that will be over the side, especially if this mission does not go well. Presumably, Matt, what the administration would say is, well, we've established with the first round of sanctions that we are prepared to use them to punish the Turks and reconstitute some measure of leverage, and that we will, as the president said yesterday, bring to bear much more if we need to. Do you anticipate that that could make a difference in behavior modification on Erdogan's part?
Nope. Qatar is going to make up the difference that you can be guaranteed of. But we've also managed to, at the same time, with this fanciful theory, is undermine everything we're doing with Iran, because now we broadcast our weakness in showing that all we are willing to do is put financial measures on. We are not willing to do anything militarily at all whatsoever. There is no red line. Even acts of war against allies, against the global economy, against our own equipment in international waters, we are not willing to do anything except put financial sanctions on. And when a country in the Middle East knows that all it needs to do is weather sanctions and there's no further penalty, it will weather those sanctions. So I'm afraid we've undermined ourselves on multiple fronts.
Matt Brodsky, we have much more to talk with you about, but I think we're at the end of our time for today. Needless to say, I very much hope that your forecast is inaccurate. I think you do too. I fear it's right, in at least broad outlines, and we will be watching closely with your help at the Gold Institute for International Strategy. We'll pick this up with you again soon. Matt, thank you so much for your time today. Keep up the good work, my friend. We'll talk with you in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for our weekly visit with Gordon Chang, one of the great thinkers and, well, increasingly influencers on matters involving China and Asia more generally. He is a contributor to the Daily Beast. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You can find him at, and I hope follow him, at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Fresh from a visit to the front lines of freedom, South Korea. Glad to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank. I really appreciate being on your show.
Well, it's always a delight to have you. Let me ask you, speaking of the front lines of freedom, we have been, of course, hearing a lot about China lately, and we could get into the NBA and LeBron James and so on, but I'm going to do that with Anders Kors in a moment. I thought I'd focus with you on the trade deal that President Trump announced late last week, a skinny deal, we're told it's being called by some. Give us a sense of what's in it, what its implications are, and what might come next.
Well, the phase one deal, as President Trump called it on Friday, includes a number of components. The most important was that on Tuesday, the United States did not increase its additional tariffs from 25% to 30%. So China's got an early harvest. President Trump said that the Chinese agreed to buy $40 to $50 billion worth of U.S. agricultural products, although he didn't specify a time frame. And it's been mentioned that there are other aspects which have yet to be defined, such as intellectual property protection, currency manipulation, and a few other things that the United States has been talking to China about. This is really, I think, an arrangement where the Chinese got an early harvest. They got two things. First of all, the deferral of the tariff increase, as just mentioned. But also, even before the deal was announced on Friday, big box retailers had heard it was coming. And so they started placing next season's orders in China instead of elsewhere. So Beijing got a lot out of this, and it's unclear what we got. Perhaps the best way to say it is we got a promise that has yet to be defined, because the Chinese and American negotiators are saying that there will need to be more meetings before this is documented.
You know, I'm struck just by one thing you already pointed out, Gordon, and that is that we're supposed to get $40 to $50 billion worth of agricultural commodity sales. That's kind of a big gap. And if there isn't specificity as to which it is, it suggests that an awful lot of this may wind up being, if I can use the expression, pigs in a poke. And I know you're skeptical about it, even if we got everything we were asking for. And given the Chinese reflexive refusal to honor their commitments, but this doesn't even seem to be much of a set of commitments on their part.
Well, Frank, it is one thing that we need to remember, and that is both China and the United States are members of the World Trade Organization. And under the organization's principles, whatever China offers to the United States has to be made available to every other WTO member, which means that if they've agreed to buy $40 or $50 billion of U.S. ag from the U.S., well, they've got to buy $40 or $50 billion of ag from every other member. There are, I think, 164 members of the WTO, which means that China's got to buy $40 to $50 billion from, I think, 162 other countries. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah, needless to say. Let me turn to Hong Kong, Gordon. There was a spectacle in the Legislative Council today as Carrie Lam, the executive chief executive of Hong Kong, China puppet, tried to hold forth and present her program. This is but the latest difficulty there. Give us your current reading on where things stand, how China is responding now that the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China is in the rearview mirror.
Well, Carrie Lam tried to give her address. It's the first time she was prevented, that any chief executive was prevented to do so. This shows something fascinating, Frank, and that is that there is an insurgency in Hong Kong, and that the insurgents come from all walks of life, not just young students and kids, but also legislators. And this means that the broad-based uprising very well should succeed, because it's got the support of a majority of people in Hong Kong. This is going to be important, because as China starts to think about what it could do, if it were to formally deploy People's Liberation Army or People's Armed Police on the streets of Hong Kong, it would be facing opposition from a majority of people in the territory. And that means a guerrilla movement with support of most people probably will succeed. And I think that's going to deter Beijing from forceful options.
Well, as you've said before, that is the best case. And I pray from your lips to God's ears, Gordon, that that's how it will play out. there does seem to be some evidence that the Chinese are going the alternative route, not the forcible crackdown, but the sort of slow, inexorable strangulation of the opposition. I was also impressed by a speech that Xi Jinping made in Nepal this week that was reported by Francis Martel at Breitbart, in which he talked about crushing the bodies and grinding the bones of those who oppose China. And he was specifically, it seemed, referring to not just opposition elements in Hong Kong, but in Taiwan and perhaps beyond. Did you see that speech? If so, did you read it the way I did?
Well, certainly there's no other way to read it. What Xi Jinping was talking, used was a traditional Chinese saying. So he didn't make up those words. But nonetheless, repeating those words has significance. I think that, if you're actually going to deploy troops, you probably are not going to talk about it so much as the Chinese have. So I think that this is really intimidation tactics to see if they can actually scare Hong Kong people. It doesn't seem to be having that much of an effect on the mentality there. What we're seeing in Hong Kong right now is a descent into violence on both sides. The excessive force of the police, brutality, allegations of sexual abuse of female detainees. All of this has led protesters to use violent means of their own, including apparently detonating a bomb remotely, though the origins of that device are not known and could very well be China itself. But the point right now is that there is almost unrestricted warfare on the streets of Hong Kong nightly. And this will continue because Beijing at this point has no clue as to how to tamp down sentiment. And Carrie Lam, as you pointed out, the Hong Kong chief executive, every time she speaks, she inflames not just the youthful protesters, she inflames middle class, massive Hong Kong people.
You'll be following it closely, Gordon, and with your help, we will as well. Thank you for your insights on what's happening there at the moment. I did want to just put in a plug, if I can, for one of the things that is pending now, namely a decision by the United States Thrift Savings Plan to invest funds of mostly retirement funds, of course, for military personnel, past and present, and other federal government employees, past and present, investing their funds in part, at least, in Chinese companies, some of which, Gordon Chang, are clearly involved in some of the very things that you're talking about. If there's any bone crushing going on at the moment, it seems to be happening in Zhanjiang, where literally graveyards are being bulldozed and bones crushed. It's the kind of thing that I would think we should find a lot of people opposing, and I hope people who are listening to this program will express that opposition by going to the Committee on the Present Danger China's website, presentdangerchina.org, and sign the petition there. It's very timely. There will be a decision presumably made next week as to whether to press on with this ill-advised idea. Gordon, very quickly, you've just come back, as I mentioned, from South Korea. You've been raising warnings about it for some time, what the Moon government is doing in South Korea. You've written a book on the subject, Losing South Korea. Tell us quickly what your takeaway was from it.
The main takeaway, Frank, was that the opposition to Moon Jae-in is not united. It's divided. It seems more interested in fighting itself than Moon. And that is extremely unfortunate because there's a critical date coming up, which is April 15th, 2020. It's the election for all 300 members of the National Assembly, the unicameral legislature. If Moon is able to slightly increase his hold on the legislature, he'll be able to amend the Constitution of South Korea. And he'll certainly take the concept of freedom out of the Constitution. He'll try to merge South Korea into North Korea. Moon is unpopular, but nonetheless, his forces are united, but the conservatives are not. The big development in South Korea recently is that Chung-kuk, the justice minister who was just appointed by Moon, has stepped down. He had to step down because he's being investigated for corruption. He should have never been appointed in the first place. His appointment resulted in an immediate drop in Moon's popularity, which was a significant drop by about 5 percentage points in a week. This is an ongoing saga, and people there are now asking for one more resignation, that of Moon Jae-in himself.
Well, again, from your lips to God's ears, I think we don't really understand how insidious it is to have someone in the position Moon enjoys as the leader of an important ally in a very, very important part of the world, now actively working with the country that has long threatened South Korea, namely North Korea, as well as increasingly our interests and forces in that region and even us here at home. Gordon, this is a topic to which we will return next week, and I look forward to hearing more about it. The opposition to Moon seems to be very large and growing. I pray that they will come together in time to effect this decision. Thank you for your time today, as always, and for the great work that you do at The Daily Beast and Fox News and so many other outlets. Come back to us again and follow Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang Twitter. Thank you so much, Gordon. I'll talk with you soon. Next up, Dr. Anders Kaur joins us. We'll visit with him about free speech and propaganda on behalf of China right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by a founding member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, Dr. Anders Kaur. He is a principal these days at Kaur Analytics and the publisher of the Journal of Political Risk. He has spent time assisting members of the United States military, the United States Army, various commands of our military in understanding challenges to our security, particularly those increasingly emanating, it's evident, from communist China. He joins us today to talk about a couple of things of interest, building on the conversation we just had with Gordon Chang. It's very good to have you with us, Dr. Kaur. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you.
Well, I guess I'd like to ask you to sort of help us understand something that this business with the NBA and the LeBron James affair have kind of brought into sharp relief. I'll be talking a little bit more about it momentarily with Dinah West, but I wanted to get your thoughts on how this fits into what seems to be an increasingly widespread pattern of American companies basically kowtowing, submitting, if you will, to China and its diktat with respect to what can be said, what can be shown, what can be marketed. Give us a flavor for the ways in which this phenomenon is now becoming evident and what it portends.
Well, LeBron James and other brands in China, because LeBron really is a brand, are seeking to protect their market share in China. There's hundreds of billions of dollars worth of trade every year with China. So there's big money at stake for these companies. And when they're comparing themselves in, you know, while they may be large companies and brands in the U.S., when they're comparing themselves to the large, you know, trillions of dollars of GDP of China, they're very small actors compared to the bargaining power of the communist China. So they have to kowtow to China if they want to keep access to the China market.
And this includes not just the NBA, of course, but outfits like Apple. And now I think these companies that are financial sector entities massively investing in Chinese companies, including perhaps imminently the retirement funds of government employees and military personnel. We talked again about this a little bit with Gordon, but what's your read on, you know, the degree to which that sheer tractor beam, for want of a better expression, of the beckoning Chinese market and the lucre that will flow to American companies that is actually affecting their conduct? DreamWorks, I guess, is now getting smacked around a little bit for kowtowing.
Yeah, when we put money into China, or we depend on Chinese revenues, as all of these companies do, and Chinese revenue flows, we essentially make our companies hostages of the Chinese communist government. They're hostages because the only way they can show growth to their shareholders is by continuing their process in China, continuing their relationship with China. And to do that, and China knows that they have so much leverage over those companies because of this. So to maintain their China market access, China demands things like, you know, when the Chinese map to be depicted with the South China Sea enclosed by the Nine Dash Line, or to show Taiwan as part of China, or to show a little sliver of land that's disputed between China and India in the Himalayan mountains as part of China. Other countries either are not as aggressive in dealing with private companies in terms of showing their preferred boundary lines, for example, or they're not really allowed to censure their own companies. So we have freedom of speech, of course, where a company like DreamWorks can show a map however they want to show it, which ironically hurts us because China doesn't have that rule and so can impinge on DreamWorks and penalize DreamWorks. So DreamWorks therefore caves to China rather than follows the U.S. But the U.S. market, it probably is more important to DreamWorks. And so if we used our market better to influence these cultural depictions, we could actually counter China. But it's a tough call because we're dealing with freedom of speech issues.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Dr. Anders Korsgaard, you have spent a lot of time in the South China Sea. You've visited each of the countries that are finding their territorial claims impinged upon by this build-out of man-made and now fortified Chinese islands there. Tell us what that nine-dash line means in sort of strategic terms and how it's likely to impinge upon our vital interests if it goes uncontested.
Well, there are trillions of dollars worth of oil and gas in the South China Sea. About a third of global shipping goes through the South China Sea. There's lots of fishing that for thousands of years, communities all around the South China Sea have depended upon for their daily sustenance. And China in 2009 unilaterally imposed the Nine Dash Line. They sent around a map to all of the UN countries, basically saying this is Chinese territory. It's similar to an interior Chinese lake, which is a complete change to what was in the past. South China Sea is about as big as all of India. So to claim the entire space through which you've got tons of shipping all the time and fishing and gas exploration.
International waters.
Yeah, it's international waters. We all use it. And they're slowly impinging. I mean, in the 70s, they fought a small war to get the Paracel Islands off of South Vietnam in the early 70s. In 1988, they killed a bunch of Vietnamese soldiers, about 60 of them, on the South Johnson Shoal. Which is actually closest to the Philippines. And then in 1995, they grabbed Mischief Reef. And in 2012, they grabbed, which is also close to Philippines. And then in 2012, they grabbed Scarborough Shoal. And Philippines is a treaty ally of the United States. We've done very little. And I would argue that the reason we've done very little to oppose China on these matters is that we're so dependent on trade with China. And we're pandering to China to ensure increased access of our corporations to the Chinese market. But that access is hurting us in a sense.
It's hurting us and will do so even more as this behavior almost certainly begins to become still more aggressive. And I wanted to ask you, you've recently written a piece about propaganda in China and how it is being used to foment nationalism and how that will inevitably translate into more aggressiveness on the part of the Chinese government and its military forces, presumably, as well. Walk us through that, if you would, please, underscore.
Well, Xi Jinping has really ramped up propaganda to his own citizens, not only to the rest of the world, and clamp down on internet freedoms. In the past, elites in China at least had access to the outside world through VPNs, but that has now stopped. The military parades are getting bigger and in a sense, more authoritarian. You've got thousands and thousands of soldiers marching through Beijing, goose-stepping with nuclear missiles driving through the city that can reach the United States. And Xi Jinping featuring himself, positioning himself next to those nuclear missiles. So it's creating an image of China for the Chinese that is profoundly authoritarian, profoundly dangerous to the rest of the world. And Chinese are buying it because they don't have a counter narrative. They don't have access to the free speech that the rest of us do. Hong Kong does. And you see the reaction against the Communist Party in Hong Kong is actually quite strong. We should expect that in China, the reaction would be similar if they only had access to the free internet. So that nationalism that Xi is pushing in China is increasing the danger that the Chinese themselves will ultimately push the Communist Party into more and more conflict with the United States, which is profoundly dangerous and increases the risk of war, actually. And sadly, Xi is overseeing all of this.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you something I put to Gordon in the last segment. This comment by Xi Jinping in Nepal this week, in which he talked about crushing the bones of his enemies, of smashing their bodies. This would seem to be a call to not just nationalism and enmity towards Hong Kong and Taiwan and perhaps others in the South China Sea and beyond, certainly us, that is ominous. Did you read it that way as well? And should we not be paying close attention to what Xi is increasingly brazenly saying he intends to do?
I think it's very ominous. I think that Xi is turning China into a massive North Korea, a much more dangerous North Korea. You know, in Hong Kong, the CCP-backed police are actually breaking bones of protesters on purpose. You can see it in videos as they arrest them and after they're already down on the ground and completely constrained. So it's not an idle threat. We can see that he's doing exactly this in the camps in Xinjiang against the Tibetans, against human rights lawyers. I mean, he's literally withholding from the Nobel Peace Laureate. He withheld the necessary cancer care, and the guy died when he could have lived.
Anders Kord, this is a topic to which we will return with you. Thank you very much for your time today, and we'll talk with you again soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, best-selling author, blogger extraordinaire, and wonderful contributor to this program with her insights into both history and contemporaneous events that is unparalleled to my way of thinking. Among other things, she has written three important books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread. We visit with her to take stock on the trends that are sometimes, despite the fact that they're much in evidence, improperly understood by too many of us, and we're delighted to do so today. Diana, thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, we have had, of course, in the past few weeks, we were talking about it with some of our guests in earlier segments, this bizarre situation where the National Basketball Association, and most recently one of its most eminent stars, LeBron James, have weighed in, basically in defense of communist China and its determined effort to suppress criticism of its politics and characteristics. And it's become a teachable moment about something that you and I have talked about many times and that deserves a great deal more attention and concern, I think, on the part of Americans. Talk to us a little bit about the insights into the assault on freedom of speech from the Chinese Quarter, among others. Dinah West?
Yes, well, this is it is a shocking moment, and it is striking in its educational possibilities, because we're not just talking about obscure politicians or writers or people struggling to keep the banner of free speech flying in sort of more rarefied provinces, but we're talking about the NBA, and we're talking about its biggest stars, and we're talking about communist China in this particular instance, where we're seeing the kowtow, the famous kowtow to communism, to the restrictions on speech and conscience that communism demands of its subjects. Who would have thought that a famous American basketball star would willingly adapt himself into that role? I mean, this is what we're seeing with LeBron James and this scandalous reaction of his when he was asked a question about this American right to criticize China or anyone else or stand up for anything in any way. And he came back with this notion that, yes, we have freedom of speech, but, and this was a shocking moment that I think is going to reverberate for some time to come in terms of really bringing people to grips with what the effect of tyranny is on their liberty.
Yeah. Let's hope so. I have to say, I've become somewhat jaded on all of this because we seem to be acceding increasingly to restrictions on our freedom of speech, whether it's the censorship that is being implemented more or less acknowledged by the Googles and the Facebooks and, you know, the YouTubes. We're also watching, of course, the insistence on restrictions on freedom of speech, lest we give offense to the easily offended Sharia supremacists, both elsewhere and here in our own country, with the Muslim Brotherhood notably, and their insistence that we conform to what amounts to Sharia blasphemy restrictions. So we're seeing these various enterprises that have sort of global reach or global ambitions, at least, imposing through one means or another for one purpose or another, essentially restrictions on speech. And it seems as though most of us are simply giving it a pass.
Well, that's true. I mean, in the sense that, yes, that is true. I guess what's different about this particular instance is that it is something with such mass appeal in terms of getting people's attention. And it could be, once again, that we will have the sorry outcome of people granting that restriction on their speech and following LeBron James. But, you know, we don't really know. I mean, somehow America elected Donald Trump in 2016. There was this outpouring of something that we didn't know was in the body politic. So I suppose it's another point on the sort of the I hope what is not the long march to silence, but it is certainly a flashpoint because of the players involved and the starkness of the conflict.
Yes. And I think also the fact that it's impelled so transparently by, to put a fine point on it, greed. The desire to not interfere with the gravy train that communist China promises, if only you'll play ball according to, well, socialism with Chinese characteristics. So, I mean, reflect on that, Dinah West. We're talking about an organization that makes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars every year from their business with China. And like so many others, they're reluctant to jeopardize that, even if it means violating fundamental American values and constitutional rights.
Right. Well, this of course is the filthy lucre that greases this tyranny. And yes, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to fight because people are weak. But again, it's something to be revolted by, and then on top of that, build in this understanding of what it is that Donald Trump is trying to do in weaning America of cheap Chinese manufacturing and rebuilding American manufacturing, just as the political and philosophical structure under this same debate now breaking out. I mean, we couldn't have even had this kind of a flashpoint come to us 5 years ago. I mean, it just wouldn't have resonated. We've really come to this moment where, as we look toward 2020 election, we are seeing an election about whether we're going to elect essentially a socialist, if not a communist, into the White House. I mean, all the Democratic candidates are party to socialist programs. And so the all of these things are coming into stark relief in ways that were not possible 10 years ago. Now, whether that is good or bad, I guess depends on the outcome, but it certainly is, you know, we do see pedal to the metal here in ways that we've been kept from. I mean, so much of this has been stealthy, and now they are making that naked grab. And so, again, you know, you just kind of hope and pray for the best of the American people and hope there are enough of the hopeful and best American people left in the country to fight this.
Yeah, and I think the starkness of the choice, too, is going to be essential to framing this and helping people understand and hopefully, as you say, respond properly to it. Speaking of the process, Dinah, just very quickly, I'm interested in your thoughts of the unfolding saga of the coup against Donald Trump. And just very quickly, Nancy Pelosi doubled down yesterday. She said she is not going to allow a vote in the House of Representatives that would have made this at least a more fair impeachment process with Republicans having certain rights. They're going to continue to do this as essentially a kangaroo court exercise. Your take on what's happening now and what its implications may be?
Well, it's horrific. I mean, it is nothing short of horrific and dangerous with a flashing red light, because what we are seeing here is a seizure of the levers of power in this. We've been using the word coup for some time now. We've watched the coup kind of move through the various departments and bureaus of the government, coming out of the intelligence and justice departments, the FBI and so on, the DNC, State Department. We're now seeing it centrally located in the House of Representatives, and we are watching the protections of our political process being seized in this, as you say, kangaroo court fashion. It should frighten people, because it is redolent of totalitarian systems where the normal political process, which is not there just for fun and not just to be correct or polite, it is there to protect us. When those normative procedures are ignored, for example, a simple, obvious step like a vote that Nancy Pelosi is preventing on this impeachment so-called inquiry, that kind of process being abandoned spells disaster in terms of people the Democratic Party muscling through this political act of arson, really, not just against Donald Trump, but again, against the American people who elected him.
We have to leave it at that. Thank you, my dear, very much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.